the underground bunker of the Civitas Studio in Raleigh, North Carolina, it's Civitalk with your hosts, Brooke Medina and Ray Nothstein. We're here to connect culture with civics, making it relevant to your daily life. And dare we say, existence at a time where too many are triggered and offended. So, relax, but buckle up, and let's wade into the deep end. What's really happening in your old North State?
Welcome to another edition of Civitalk. This is Brooke Medina, and today I am joined by a guest co-host, Andy Jackson. He is our elections policy analyst here at Civitas Institute. So very glad that he's here while Ray decided to leave me high and dry. He's on vacation, but Andy is definitely well-prepared and talented enough to fill in this this void today. So Andy, thanks for joining.
No problem. Just everybody, imagine, close your eyes and imagine it's Ray here and maybe we get through this.
No, it's going to be great, especially because as we near the primaries, your focus is elections policy. And I think you have some unique insights into the electoral landscape in our state. But, you know, let's kick it off with something that's way more important than elections, and that is food. How do you feel about food, Andy? You like food?
As anybody who has ever seen me knows, I am a big fan of food. And I mean, I've eaten all kinds, and I don't think I've ever had as far as like an ethnicity of food that I could say was not really good. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm particularly fond. I mean, I love Southern food, love Korean food, Japanese food, Ethiopian food, Senegalese food. That's Senegalese.
Off the beaten path foods.
I've lived in a lot of different places. I've never lived in Senegal, but there was a Senegalese restaurant in the neighborhood I lived in D.C. And so I occasionally went in there and they had some really nice stuff.
Well, can you describe Senegalese food to me? Because I don't think I've ever had it.
It's been years ago. I just remember I liked it. They do.
Well, that's the important thing.
At least the place I ate at, they did serve couscous, which is a different set of grain. I think probably about half of Americans have eaten it at this point. It's, I don't even know what they make it out of, millet or something. And then it's just the local herbs and vegetables. I can probably describe Ethiopian better than Senegalese because I've eaten it a little more. But Senegalese, I just remember it was good and I liked it when I ate it.
Don't we have an Ethiopian restaurant here in Raleigh?
Well, we have a couple. There's one over, I forget the area, just south of NC State, near, I forget the name of the Ethiopian restaurant, but it's right next to where the Daylat Vietnamese restaurant is.
Okay.
Just off of Western Boulevard. And I know we have at least one Ethiopian place in Durham, too, and probably by now it's a couple. So if you want a different experience, if you like eating with your fingers, and I'm sure different restaurants can give you a spoon if you really want one. But if you want to go for the full thing, you have this injera bread.
Yeah, I'm a spoon eater. I need spoons. I would be that person that asked for it and say, I don't want to mess up my fingers.
Yeah. So, you don't actually touch the saucy part because you have this kind of spongy bread.
Oh,
and
okay.
You need that to pick up the food. And so you're basically making these small hand-sized sandwiches, every time you take a bite.
Oh, neat. Well, that sounds kind of fun. I know my friends, they had adopted a little girl from Ethiopia a number of years ago. She is, I think, 7 years old now. And so they lived in the Triangle. And so they would go to some Ethiopian restaurants around here to sort of, remind her of her roots and, experience that together as a family, which I thought was neat. And, I know you said you are married to a Korean, right? Mm-hmm. And so you have lots of Korean yumminess in your home.
I do. That's a blessing that I have because I really, really like Korean food and I can't make it well, but my wife can. So that makes life a lot easier. And, especially since Korean food in the restaurants tends to be so expensive. And for me personally, because I had lived in Korea for a while. And stuff that I'm used to paying the equivalent of $3 or $4 cost about 10 or 12 here. And so even if I like it, I just can't get past the mental block of saying, man, this is way more expensive than it should be.
Right. Yeah, for sure. Well, yeah, my husband's mom is Puerto Rican. So whenever we go to her house, I absolutely love Puerto Rican food. And so she whips up a bunch of it for us and like feeds us until we can't even button our pants anymore. So it's wonderful having these multi-ethnic experiences when it comes to food. And of course, my dad's family, they're from Hawaii. So we get some good Hawaiian food, such as kalua pig and manapua and long rice, which are all just delightfully yummy. But I know that we also have some deeper things to discuss today, although I could talk about food all morning long. But let's go ahead and talk about this Democratic debate that happened this last week. So did you watch part of it?
I watched some of it. You know, when you're raising kids, you've got to do a lot of other things. Although, you know, it was nice that it was late. I also had to do a little bit of work. But I was able to watch some. I generally don't watch debates. I just I get most of my information by reading and seeing plans. And a lot of times for me, debates seem to be these kind of semi-organized dog and pony shows.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
Well, I suspected that this one was going to be interesting, and it turned out it was. Probably more accurate to say is it was brutal. Mike Bloomberg took a beating. This was his first debate. The DNC rewrote the rules so that he could be included. And I don't think that the DNC did Bloomberg any favors by changing the rules so that he could be in on this debate, because it's pretty clear that he wasn't ready. There were some questions. They would hit him with these things. And one of the things you have to do in these debates is be able to roll with the punches,
right,
and come back and answer. And he seemed to be caught flat-footed on a lot of these things. You know, all these campaigns, they hire people to go in and be surrogate speakers when they do practice debates, and they do their kind of self-opposition research, so they should know what the lines of attack are going to be. But it seems like Bloomberg didn't have that kind of preparation. So at least initially, he kind of got a little bit of steam later on, but at least initially, it really looked bad for him. And he had been making a lot of gains in the polling. He'd been picking up a lot of endorsements. The interesting thing to see is how much will this just be a pause in his otherwise quick rise, or is this going to be something that ultimately derails his campaign?
Yeah, I think that that's a valid question, especially given, I think there was a recent North Carolina poll done by WRAL News, and Bloomberg was one of the top candidates across the state in the Democratic primaries. It was Bloomberg, Sanders, and Biden. I believe they were all almost in a three-way tie. So it'll be interesting to see if his debate performance really actually manifests in a polling impact, a negative impact for him, or if people will kind of look over this sort of some of these accusations that were leveled at him during the debate, similar to how they've kind of been forgiving of some of Biden's blunders in the past. But of course, as things have progressed, Biden has definitely dropped in the polls. So maybe long term, this has a very negative effect on Bloomberg. We'll see.
Yeah, it could be. And I should say one more thing. When people start, as far as people are influenced by returns in other states, and research has shown that in our sequential system of electing presidents, you know, what happens in Iowa does make a difference. What happens in New Hampshire does make a difference. Bloomberg is not on the ballot in Nevada or South Carolina. And so, but people have seen his ads, they've seen him on the debate stage. And I don't know how many people are aware that he's not going to be voted on by anybody until Super Tuesday on March 3rd. So people might take a negative inference of not seeing him among the top finishers in those two elections just because he's not on the ballot.
Now, why isn't he on the ballot in Nevada and South Carolina?
Basically, he didn't sign up to play. His whole strategy is avoiding those early states where, you know, the other opponents can concentrate resources and be able to totally outspend and out-organize them in the Super Tuesday states. Others have tried this. Rudy Giuliani tried this when he ran. It ended disastrously for him. and that's generally because people start moving on to other candidates and your fundraising dries up. But of course, that's not a problem for Mike Bloomberg.
Yeah. He's got plenty of money. He's the ninth wealthiest person in the world, right? Or in America.
I don't know the exact number, but I know he is mega rich and he has shown a propensity to spend that money and spend it freely. So I don't expect that to change. And so maybe he can overwhelm this negativity that he's experiencing now just by throwing enough money at it. We'll see.
Yeah, you know something before we move on, something that just kind of perplexes me, and I really just sense this cognitive dissonance, especially on the left and in the Democratic Party in particular, is that we have these three septuagenarian candidates, Bloomberg, Biden, and Sanders, and at least with Biden and Bloomberg, there are some women problems that come along with them. That's their baggage. For example, Elizabeth Warren went after Bloomberg during this debate and said that, you know, he's had a record of calling women fat broads, horse-faced lesbians, as well as even making a few women that worked with him sign non-disclosure agreements. And then we don't have to rehash some of Biden's snafus of being just creepy, for lack of a better term. Bernie Sanders has, kind of had his own problems, although it's not been manifested the same way as kind of like sexual harassment, but sort of this, there have been just accusations leveled against him by Elizabeth Warren, which I think ended up hurting Warren later. But I don't know. I mean, what are your thoughts on like culture and how it seems like the left is just so focused on the Me Too movement in so many cases and yet seems to be willing to set that aside when it comes to their presidential candidates?
Well, some of them. I mean, in Sanders' case, of course, he's famous for his supporters, the so-called Bernie bros. And he generally does do much better among males. I think the fact that you have two women candidates, and by the way, Elizabeth Warren is also 70 years old, so you can put her in the candidates club. Although she is the young one of the bunch, she's only 70.
spring chicken.
Yes, relatively speaking. I think it, to a degree at least, it has hurt both of them. I mean, they were raised in a different time. I mean, the era covered by that TV series Mad Men, I mean, that was their, you know, that was their youth. I mean, that's when they were growing up. And so, you know, they have habits of speech that are probably, you know, not acceptable by the standards of a lot of people, especially younger people today. So that has caused them some damage, at least. The thing is, once you get in, you know, whoever the Democratic nominee is, there will end up being forgiven for whatever those those things they say or do. I mean, you can go back to Bill Clinton. People don't remember this, but in the early and mid 90s, there was a similar thing going on. There was this whole big to do leading off from the Clarence Thomas confirmation hearing. There were people getting attacked over issues of alleged sexual harassment in the early 90s, and that lasted up until Bill Clinton's impeachment. And after that, the people that had been really pushing that realized that, hey, we're dealing with a president that is being accused of using his office to gain sexual favors from underlings. Mm-hmm. And so that movement, rather than pushing through and potentially claiming Bill Clinton as a victim, we ended up with the so-called one free grope rule, where if you harass somebody and then she says no and you don't pursue it after that, then you're off scot-free. And I believe that came from none other than, she didn't use this, those exact words, but this came in a New York Times editorial from Gloria Steinem, of all people.
Oh, interesting. I did not know this.
So this is coming full circle now. And so the question is, are people on the left going to be as forgiving now over these kind of things as they were with Bill Clinton back in the 1990s? It's one of those time will tell things. And we'll see if one of these gentlemen does get the nomination, how people react to those things.
Certainly, it should be interesting to watch play out, and I'm curious, how the Me Too conversation will shape the actual presidential debate once they've settled on a nominee, depending on who that is. I think if it's if it's a female Democratic nominee, she will inevitably take the high ground and go after Trump in this respect. They can't really attack him on the economy for the most part. And so I think that might be something that a female candidate could leverage that most male candidates that are currently on the field, or at least Biden and Bloomberg, just really, really can't tap into. It will be more about whataboutism, you know, and pointing fingers to see who was the worst aggressor on that front. But let's pivot real quick, because we have a lot of other stuff happening in our state. But I wanted to spend just a minute or two talking about challenges of parenting in 2020, you know, especially because some of our kids are watching these debates. So we're having these conversations with them. At least I have teenagers in my home now. I don't think you have kids quite that old yet. But, you know, we're having some of these discussions about politics and, you know, social media use and things like that. So first off, how many kids do you have and how old are they?
I have three, and my oldest one is 14. So she's okay. Starting on that path now. And I have, so she's my oldest daughter. I have a 12-year-old son and an 8-year-old daughter.
Okay, so your kids, they are kind of mirroring some of my kids' ages or close enough. I do have a 16-year-old daughter, though, and then 13-year-old son, 11-year-old daughter, and 6-year-old son. Okay. And my 16-year-old and I were driving in the car the other day, and she was talking to me about how TikTok, you know, teaches people to dance, essentially, because there's all these songs that people put on there, and they create these dances to them. And so you can learn all sorts of new dances. It's not just a dance to the Macarena or Keep It Shuffle now. It's for any and every song you can find a dance. And so I decided to follow that up with, hey, should we make a TikTok together? Come on, let's make a TikTok. And she was not having that. So I was wondering if you were having any parental woes like that, where your kids just don't think you're cool enough. Because that's definitely what I'm getting in my home.
Well, I think my kids have gone to the acceptance phase that I'm not cool. So they're basically all right with it now. My oldest just assumes that I have no idea of the things she's talking about, which is probably true about half the time. But since I have to work in a little bit of social media, although Twitter is becoming increasingly the old person social media, I am told. But I still have to deal with other issues, though. Like, I'll have one example is, you know, some of the movies that I really like that I've watched when I was, a few years back, I'm used to kind of the TV version of those movies. And so every once in a while, I'll say, oh, there's a movie I remember that I like that movie. When on Netflix, well, Netflix, of course, doesn't have the TV edited version of those movies. So I have occasionally come across a scene that I had forgotten existed. Which, you know, might have some more violence than I wanted or some nudity that I'd forgotten was in there. And so I have to like quickly find the remote. So I'm not as good about pre-filtering, I guess, some of these things, especially for my younger kids, as I should. So it's usually safer just to stay in the shallow water on those things and look for the ratings, which,
Disney Junior, that's what I say. Just stick with Disney Junior till they're 20.
I think I might have to do that. I do try to do activities with the kids, take them out. Some friends of mine and I are having this father-son gaming night tomorrow night, assuming that the roads aren't shut down through the, you know, Snowgeddon 2.0 or whatever. But we haven't figured out. We might be doing either board games or maybe computer games. I have a friend that has access to enough computers. We're going to string together and run these team games on landlines. I might have my first experience playing Fortnite.
Quite the inauguration into parenting in 2020. I feel like there needs to be at least some level of some framework for understanding Fortnite and being able to at least pretend like you know what you're talking about with your kids. At least that's how I've approached it. So I drove my 13-year-old to school this morning and he talked nonstop to me, which I loved, which was great because sometimes it's hard to get your kids to talk to you at that age. But he was talking about all the video games and like the new Sonic movie that just got released and different awards that certain video games had won. And I feel like there needs to be some sort of parenting class for how to talk to your kids about this, like, gamer lingo for kids that are in that world. So if there's one that one of you listeners knows about, please send me an email because I need to attend it, I do believe. But Andy, let's go ahead and talk about something that is just huge, and it feels like it is the problem that never ends, and it's related to voter ID. So a 3-judge panel just issued at the state level, just issued a preliminary injunction blocking voter ID indefinitely. Is that right?
Indefinitely. Well, until they have the trial. So this is just the injunction. So we can't have, we cannot enforce voter ID, which is already not enforced for the primary. But this makes it look likely, considering the pace that this case is going, this injunction probably will still be in place through the general this fall. Mm-hmm. The other issue is there's no appeal here because all three judges agreed on this one. So I don't expect that the defendants in this case, the legislative defendants, are going to appeal this to the North Carolina Supreme Court. And even if they did, considering the composition of the court currently with 6 Democrats and 1 Republican, they might not want to. Because their likelihood of succeeding is low. So until we get to the actual trial, it looks like we're not going to have voter ID in North Carolina.
What do you, okay, so I monitor Civitas's social media accounts. And so I know you just recently wrote on this, updating our readers about what was happening. And a lot of the reactions were just obviously filled with anger and frustration, but some points were made related to the fact that the people of North Carolina voted for this. And so where does democracy end, I guess, on this front, and judicial preferences begin? I mean, and it just help us make sense of how the judges are viewing this and approaching this case.
Well, and this is, even though we're dealing with state law, they did also talk about the voter ID laws in South Carolina, Virginia, the Virginia one, which is actually being taken back by the legislature. But both of those had already been ruled as being, you know, not discriminatory. So those were upheld. But the difference was because an earlier law, the basic line of reason is an earlier law had been struck down. In the federal courts as being discriminatory, an earlier voter ID law. And what the courts have done is they have ruled that, or they have said that since most of the legislators who voted for that earlier voter ID bill also voted for this one, they have essentially tainted this bill with discriminatory intent. So essentially, as long as we have the same people in the North Carolina state legislature, or at least largely the same amount of people voting for this, the courts allow plaintiffs to set a lower bar. Things that you could not use to prove discriminatory intent in other cases, like you had of South Carolina, Virginia, they can do here. So in essence, the courts are saying that there is no voter ID law that the North Carolina General Assembly can pass unless they get a bunch of Democrats on board. And the likelihood of that is, of course, very, very low unless you water it down to the point of being meaningless.
Right. And then, I mean, so what do you expect is going to eventually happen? I mean, this is going to go to the U.S. Supreme Court, do you think? I recognize that at the state Supreme Court, there's going to be some there's not really much traction that pro-voter ID people can gain. But is the next step at the federal level going to be the Supreme Court?
You can appeal, but you'd have to show that in the ruling, the state Supreme Court violated some principle of the U.S. Constitution, and that's probably going to be hard to do. Now, my reaction to a similar injunction in federal court was, you know, this is going to get overturned because it was just a silly line of reasoning. But frankly, with the state court system the way it is, I know this is a frustrating thing to say, but at this point, unless we can show, and by the way, I think there's a good reason to believe that we could show this, that this appeals court was somehow in error or decided this ruling improperly, or that the judges should have not been on this case at all, that might be a means of getting this back. Because, you know, this was a highly unusual panel. And it's a set of weird coincidences, if you believe in coincidences, that got these three particular judges on this panel. And it just so happened that this panel was the one that heard this voter ID case. So, for example, two of the judges had already stated during the 2018 campaign when they were running for election that they opposed the voter ID amendment. And this is really important because it's showing that they already had a view on voter ID before it came before them in the court. And so there's a reason that Civitas has actually come out and made a complaint about this, that judges...
Well, it shows that there's no impartiality on this, correct? Right. I mean, something justice is supposed to be blind, and yet they've already stated their opinion on it.
And they have. And so this was John Arrowood, Toby Thompson. Those are the two judges in question. And so, yeah, this does cast substantial doubt on their capacity to decide impartially any case involving voter ID. So, you know, if you talk about being tainted, these judges have already tainted, you know, any possibility that they could be seen as being impartial in a case involving voter ID. So they should have recused themselves.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so, like Andy noted, we have filed an ethics complaint related to both of those judges. And so if you want to keep up with that and follow it, go to our website at nccivitas.org, and we will definitely keep the public up to date on the progress of that. But this is something that I know a lot of North Carolina voters feel very strongly about, rightfully so. It's something that their voice was made abundantly clear on in the 2018 election when they voted for this to be added as a constitutional amendment. And so we will be following it. Andy is definitely the resident expert on this and all things elections. So you can continue to keep track with up to date with his writings on our website as well. But one last thing that I wanted to remind our listeners of is our upcoming Conservative Leadership Conference. The tickets are on sale. We're so excited about it. We will continue to release speaker names, and we've got our keynote speaker that we're going to be releasing soon. And I know that those that are listening will not want to miss it. So if you go to civitasclc.org, you can purchase your tickets there, and you will also find speaker updates. But Andy, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Oh, it's always nice to be with you.
All right. Have a good day.